Well, good morning, brethren. As has been said a number of times, it is a beautiful Sabbath day. And isn't it interesting how fickle we can be as humans? 6 months ago, we were saying, oh, we'll never complain about heat again. It's so cold, and I'm tired of the snow and this frost on my windshield. I have to scrape every day. Speaking of scraping every day, some have asked about the unusual growth on my face. I broke my razor. I backed over it twice to make sure. And we thought a change might be nice. The benefit is you see less of my face. It started March 11th, 2011, just off the coast, at 2:46 in the afternoon. It was an earthquake off the coast of Japan. And many of us remember the footage that we saw from the aftermath of that particular quake. I think one of the first images I remember seeing was of a wall of water coming ashore on a coastal plain where a number of greenhouses were set up, row after row, and quite long rows too. And seeing that wall of water just knock those down as if they were toys, as if they were made of styrofoam, almost as if they were made of plastic. Well, they were made of plastic, but that's not the point. And that wall of water just kept coming. And we saw other images or videos online of towns inside a village center. And one I watched, it was at least 15 minutes long, and it showed water slowly trickling up a street. And observant people, those who understand what had just happened, were wise enough to go to the parking lot, grab the keys of their car, start the vehicle from the parking lot and head for higher ground. Others did not have that same foresight, and unfortunately the water kept rising. You've seen the images, but the current starts to swirl by, debris starts to float past, and before long the cars begin to be lifted up. The buoyancy of the interior of the cabin allows it to be buoyant in the water. And then cars start being moved around, and before long you can see boats coming up the street from wherever the harbor was in that village. And now boats are crashing into cars and trucks are being moved around as though they're bath toys in the turmoil of the water. And what was worse was seeing small buildings being moved, crushed, sent down the raging stream. And what shocked me the most was seeing an entire house start to shift. Did any of you see videos like that as well? Where an entire building, a house, was moved off its foundations and carried down the street wherever the water was headed. Another part of the video, or another video perhaps, showed warehouses being moved around as though they were little bath toys. And of course, we saw pictures after the fact of houses floating in the Pacific as the water took them inland and then carried them out to sea, where they spent the rest of their short bobbing life. That was just the beginning of the woes, wasn't it, for the Japanese islands. Shortly thereafter, the power was cut to the Fukushima plant, one of the many nuclear plants that they had in Japan. And as a result of the power or outage, the cooling systems failed. And when the cooling systems failed, they had a meltdown in the reactors. And in the aftermath of the core meltdown of the hydrogen explosions inside those reactors, somebody came forward, Mr. Yasutera Yamada. He was a 60-year-old retiree. He was an engineer. And he saw pictures of his younger countrymen going into the danger zone, into the nuclear facility, risking their lives to help solve this problem. And he contacted one of his closer friends and said, "This is not right. We need to do something." So they developed a plan and formed the Japanese Skilled Veterans Corps, comprised entirely of retirees, 60 years and older, up to 80-something years, of volunteers. They stepped forward and offered their assistance to the government because they were skilled laborers, they were engineers, they were scientists. And they gave two reasons why they should be allowed to go into this danger zone and relieve the younger workers who were there. They said, number one, scientists and engineers helped create this problem. You should let us, scientists and engineers of our generation, help solve the problem. And number two, he said there are dangers of radiation poisoning to those younger workers who were 30-some-odd years in age. He reasoned that he had maybe another 15 years left to live. Cancer would take maybe 20 to 30 years to set in if overexposed to radiation. Therefore, such a risk would be very minimum to him and his colleagues. And they should shoulder the burden, not the youthful workers who would then have to live with the consequences of that overexposure. Some in the government sniffed at their offer, comparing them to kamikazes, to which Mr. Yamada is quite offended because it is a reasoned decision where there is a quite reasonable chance of survival, unlike the pilots who were bolted into their cockpits without fuel to come back. So he pointed to a very different background, a very different reasoning to their offer to help. And some say that with these retirees, they have limited economic output in society. In many ways, Japan is losing some of its respect to the elderly, although they certainly do have much more than our culture has retained. These folks saw themselves as having a diminished youthfulness or usefulness in their society, and this was how they were going to help. Unexpected help, unexpected potential saviors. Turn with me, please, to the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers, chapter 13. My chapter heading in the Bible reads, Exploring Canaan. The Israelites have wandered, and now they have come to a threshold. Verse 1 of chapter 13 of Numbers. The Lord said to Moses, Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. So at the Lord's command, Moses sent them out from the desert of Paran. All of them were leaders of the Israelites. Verse 4, these are their names. You can see a list of names from verse 4 through verse 15, including Joshua, the son of Nun, or Hoshea, and Caleb are both mentioned here. Verse 16, these are the names of the men Moses sent to explore the land. Moses gave Hoshea, son of Nun, the name Joshua. Verse 17, when Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country, see what the land is like, and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or is it bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land, for it was the season of the first ripe grapes. Verse 21, so they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob towards Lebo Hamath. They went up through the Negev and came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, lived. Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Verse 23, when they reached the valley of Eshol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. Now, how many of you remember the illustration by Mr. Wolverton in the Bible story books? Remember those? I often wondered what a PB&J would taste like made from those grapes. How big would the bread have to be to properly compensate for the size of those grapes? Verse 24, that place was called the Valley of Eshul because of the cluster of grapes the Israelites cut off there. Verse 25, and at the end of 40 days they returned from exploring the land. And now they give the report in verse 26. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is the fruit. However, the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large, and we even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Phlalites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan. Verse 30, then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of this land, for we can certainly do it. And so we see a divergence in opinion after their reconnaissance. Reconnaissance is actually quite old, isn't it? I remember a story that my grandfather told me about a reconnaissance mission he was sent on during World War II. He was assigned to the 103rd Cactus Division, which has now been retired. And as the draft board was so able to do, they apparently had a sense of humor. When they asked him where he'd like to serve, he said, I'd like to be in the cavalry. They said, well, we've done away with the cavalry. However, we do have a reconnaissance unit you can join up with. It's kind of the new cavalry. And so he spent the majority of the war attached to, or close to, his Jeep. And so it was in 1945, he was outside a German town with their unit, some mile or so away from town. And the captain of the reconnaissance unit told the sergeant, Sarge, I need you to pick two volunteers to go into town, find a house, secure it, and have one of them report back. Well, the sergeant was apparently a good guy. He said, no, I can't ask for two volunteers. However, I will volunteer and get one other volunteer. My grandfather heard this and apparently was appreciative of it, so immediately volunteered to go with the sergeant. So off they went, through the woods, coming to a clearing just outside of town, and between them and the town was a minefield. So they walked carefully through the minefield, negotiated around those mines. Thankfully, they were not anti-personnel mines, but were anti-vehicle mines, so they were easily identified when walking. They made it through, found a house, and they burst through with their weapons drawn to find an empty house. So the sergeant volunteered to stay behind and asked my grandfather to go back to his cavalry division, to his unit, and lead them back to the house that the sergeant had secured. Well, wouldn't you know it, about this time the sun is setting. It's getting dark. And by the time he makes it back to the edge of the minefield, it is getting dark. The first time he went across the minefield, he did so carefully. And when he went back across, he did so very carefully. Thankfully, there was just enough light for him to make out where he should step, or more importantly, where he shouldn't step. Made it through the minefield safely, and about halfway back to his home position, he heard a four-letter word, halt. And he did. And in the process of interrogation in the dark, he discovered that he had been stopped by an American patrol. He identified himself, let them know what he was doing, where he was, and what his mission was to be. But they didn't believe him. Well, earlier in the war, the Battle of the Bulge, Nazi soldiers were sent behind lines, dressed up as Allied soldiers, complete with uniform and dog tags, and their job was to confuse the Allies. They would change around the signs on the road, which may be why some of us men don't like asking for directions, because we can never be sure they can be trusted. But because of that, the patrols were under a heightened sense of alertness and less willing to believe what is being said. So my grandfather was arrested, detained at best, and brought back to a command post in the 103rd, where he was again interrogated. He explained what he was doing, what his job was, what he needed to be doing instead of talking in the tent. They said, impossible. You could not have gotten through that minefield at dark unless, of course, you're working for the other side. With the last name like Esslinger, it's not unimaginable. Well, he was able to shimmy his way close to the tent. The CO noticed that and said, if he leaves his tent, shoot him in the back. Well, he took his chances, dove out the tent. There were no shots, and was able to blend in with the darkness. He was worried that his reconnaissance unit would have left without him and not known where to meet up with the sergeant in town. He didn't want either of them to be abandoned. So he did make it back to his unit, relieved. And they said, we weren't worried. We knew you'd come back. Well, by that time, he was able to lead them back again through the forest and to the minefield and across the minefield and just in time for the sun to come up so they could get through in daylight hours. But the whole point was to get to that town and to get back unseen, unnoticed, undetected. Much as the spies were sent in here in the book of Numbers to go into the promised land, Joshua included. This would not be the last of Joshua's exposure to reconnaissance, would it? Let's take a look at Joshua chapter 2. Joshua chapter 2. Here we have a transition from Moses' leadership of the Israelites to Joshua's leadership. And it is time to enter into the promised land 40 years later. Chapter 2, verse 1. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies. Have you ever wondered the conversation that Joshua and God must have had following the first debacle? This is a very different scenario. The first time, God asks for 12 leaders to go in, one leader from each tribe to spy out the land. And here we see two are sent in. In the first instance, there was a public report. Did the whole camp know the promised land was being explored? Secrets are hard to keep in that situation. But here, Joshua the son of Nun secretly sent two spies. Well, if they're spies, by definition, there should be some secrecy. But here, it seems as though only Joshua knew, or those with Joshua knew. Things are different here, aren't they? He sent two spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. This wasn't Joshua's first rodeo. And some changes were made, either of his own initiation or through God's guidance. We do see some very distinct differences here, don't we? Question, did God need the spies? Either the first time or the second time. He knew what was there, didn't he? And yet he instructed Moses the first time and Joshua the second time to send spies into the land so they could see with their own eyes. It's one thing hearing a story, but it's something else to see it and to talk to a person who's seen it, someone you can relate to. Perhaps that's what's going on here. Reconnaissance is not an easy job. But we see it used here in Scripture. So in verse 1, Joshua sends them to go look into the land, especially Jericho. Why Jericho? What was significant about Jericho? Well, Jericho was located about 10 miles north of the Dead Sea, about 4 miles to the west, of the Jordan River. And it was situated rather centrally between mountains to the east, mountains to the west, and to the Dead Sea to the south. The city itself was actually below sea level, some 600 feet or so. However, it had quite an extensive aquifer system feeding it from the mountains. And so it had a number of springs that created an oasis in this particular city setting. So it would have been a very lush and green, welcoming place to come to coming out of a parched and dry desert, and served as a very important trade route for those coming from the Orient, north and south into Arabia. So it's strategically important for trade, but for God's purposes. Why Jericho? Well, beyond being centrally located in those geographic features, it was also roughly central in the land of Canaan. When Moses and the spies from the book of Numbers were exercising their entry into the promised land, they did so from the south, you will remember. But this time they're doing it from the center. Why? Why the center? Well, I mentioned earlier about the Battle of the Bulge, also known as the Ardennes Offensive. This started towards the end of 1944. And at this particular point, Hitler had been driven back from France after the invasion of Normandy, steadily, constantly being encroached from the west. And at one point, they formed a western wall, roughly around the borders of Germany, where they held the Allies back for a period of time. Hitler realized that his situation was rather dire, They were starting to run low on petroleum reserves. After the Romanian oil fields had been bombed, they no longer had the ability to fuel themselves. And in a war, airplanes work better with fuel, as do tanks and other heavy equipment. People, they get by on food, but for heavy equipment, you need to have fuel. And they were lacking that. They were being squeezed also from the east on the Russian frontier. And Hitler realized that if they were to go into a defensive holding pattern, it's going to end rather poorly. So he decided on one last push to strike westward towards the Allies. He realized that the Allies were having a supply problem of their own. For the invasion of Normandy, the Allied Air Force had bombed a lot of the French rail networks. That presented a problem for the occupying Nazi army of being able to get supplies into France and also to get equipment and troops in once the invasion got underway. It backfired on the Allies when they took France and moved beyond France's borders, or to the extent of France's borders, because then they could not supply themselves, up until the point where they were able to capture the port of Antwerp in Belgium. They had a deep water port where heavy ships could come in and unload all kinds of supplies, and they were beginning to feel the benefits of that. Well, Hitler reasoned that what he needed to do was to strike back. From the Ardennes forest, the border of Germany and France and Luxembourg, his design was to strike eastward and then to strike west and then northwest and take that port so the Allies would no longer have the ability to supply themselves. Well, in the early mornings of December 16th, it started with a 90-minute barrage involving 1,600 guns. They were pounded. Well, for Hitler's plan to work, they needed a surprise. They achieved surprise. Partially because there was overcast skies and fog in the area, allowing him to build up troops in the forest, unseen. And the weather had to hold out since the Luftwaffe had been paralyzed or at least crippled. So the Allies could not rely on air support. They had to move quickly. Number three and number four, they had to capture fuel reserves. It started out quite well, and they made quite a dent in the line, hence the term Battle of the Bulge. They took a relatively straight line east to west and punched a significant proboscis into it and inflicted significant damage. His strategy was to take that port, but also to circle Canadian Army Division, a British division, and two U.S. armies as well, encircle them, decimate them, and negotiate favorable peace treaties so he could then focus on Stalin. His design was to divide and conquer. What does this have to do with Jericho? Good question. I'm glad you asked. Jericho was centrally located. And a number of Bible commentaries praise Joshua up and down, saying, what a brilliant military strategist. He knew that taking Jericho would allow him then to have an operations point where he could strike north and south and to the Mediterranean Sea and split Canaan in two to divide and conquer Canaan. As though Joshua were working by himself. I think we clearly understand that this was God's design, God's providence at work. This wasn't Jericho's brilliant or Joshua's brilliance. God revealed that plan to him. So that's why Jericho was important. So what happens in Jericho? Joshua 2, verse 1.5. So they, the spies, went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. Well, so much for secrecy. How did he know so quickly? Was it their dress? Was it the way they talked? Was it because they turned down the free ham sandwiches at the town square? What was it? How did they know? Somehow they knew. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house because they have come to spy out the whole land. Verse 4, but the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gates, the men left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up on the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax that she had laid on the roof. Potential interesting side note. Her profession is listed here. What's she doing messing around with flax? Was she diversifying her income? Is there more to this person than we might normally think? How is it that she just happened to have enough on the roof of her house? Verse 7, so the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan, and as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. They're trapped. They have no way out. What are they going to do? Verse 8, before the spies lay down for the night, she went up to the roof and she said to them, I know that the Lord has given this land to you and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea when you came out of Egypt. How old was she? This happened 40 years ago. Was she a 40-year-old engaged in this profession? Had she been told this by her parents, by those in the city? This was notable. And it's interesting how stories change over time. How many of you know fishermen? You can admit to it. Go ahead. Just one person knows a fisherman. Okay. I caught a fish, and how does the story start? The first telling, and how does it change over time? It's remarkable how that fish grows, right? How exaggerations occur. What does she say? Verse 10, for we heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you. They did walk on dry land, but that's not a complete or accurate picture of what occurred, is it? But it did serve a purpose. And what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. Now, it's interesting that she notes these two occurrences in this order. Which occurred first? She may be listing this in order in emotional impact order, isn't she? The Red Sea being the most impactful. Verse 11, when we heard of it, our hearts melted and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. Here we seem to see an understanding that Rahab had for God. She didn't just know about him, but she understood his place, his full power. And recognize the difference between the gods of the land of Canaan, maybe a specific god of the city of Jericho. But she recognized the difference in the God of Israel as being God in heaven and on earth. He's not far removed. He's involved in heaven, but he's involved on earth as well. Verse 12, now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to me alone, because I'm the most important. What does she say? Show kindness to who? My family, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father, my mother, my brothers, and my sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. So Rahab wasn't just interested in saving her own skin, was she? She could have. But she was interested in preserving not only her life, but her family's life. And some have speculated, therefore, the family must have also shared her understanding, at least partly, if not mostly, of who God was, who the God of Israel was, and shared a belief that they were destined to take over the land of Canaan. Otherwise, would they agree to this? that you would spare the lives of my father and mother and my brother and sisters and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. The response, our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If, again, the biggest two-letter word in the English language, there are conditions to this covenant. If you don't tell what we are doing, number one, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us the land. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. Now she had said to them, go to the hills so the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there for 3 days until they return, and then go on your way. What a remarkable lady. How did she know it was going to take 3 days for these pursuers to give up? She had a house on the wall. Was she able to see them leave and gauge how much food or provisions they had with them? Did she know the personality of the individuals going? Did she know how determined they would be? If they were hard workers, if they were lazy? Well, 3 days is a long time to be in the desert looking for something that isn't there. But still, she gave them 3 days. And then go on your way. Verse 17, the men said to her, this oath you made us swear will not be binding on us. Here's the other part of the escape clause. Unless when we enter the land you have, number one, tied this scarlet cord, a very symbolic scarlet cord, in the window through which you let us down. Are they yelling this from the ground? How are they able to be quiet enough to communicate with her through that window, which, through which you let us down, not through which you are going to let us down? Moot point. I'll stop being curious and read. Sorry. And unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family into your house, if anyone goes outside your house into the street, his or her blood will be on his or her own head. We will not be responsible. As for anyone who is in the house with you, his blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear. Question. Boy, this Wazikoff guy is full of questions, isn't he? How is it that God led them to Rahab, who understood where they needed to hide, how long they needed to hide in those hills? How is it that God led them to Rahab, who just happened to have an inn large enough to accommodate her family to hide during the destruction of the city? How is it that she happened to have a home in the wall where these men could be let down? And apparently she had a rooftop. This wasn't just in the middle of the wall. It would seem it would be towards the top of the wall so that these men could be hidden underneath the flax. Isn't that a remarkable number of coincidences? Well, we're not serving a God of coincidences, are we? We're serving the God who knows the end from the beginning. And his wisdom is so high above ours, he's able to plan these things out. Verse 21. Agreed, she replied. Let it be as you say. So she sent them away, and they departed. And she tied the scarlet cord in the window. I'm a worrywart. There are times when I start worrying when I'm not worrying because I worry that I might have forgotten something to worry about, and that is the thing I should be worrying about. Are there any others out there like me? Some of you are smiling politely. I'm not sure if that means that poor guy, we need to pray harder for him, or if it means you understand or empathetic, and others are just shaking your head thinking, I knew there was something wrong. But I can't imagine how many times she checked that window for that cord. Is it still there? I check it all the time. Is that cord still there? What an important thing now, not just for her life, but for the lives of her father, her mother, her brothers, her sisters, and all who belong to them. Verse 22, then they left, or when they left, rather, they went into the hills and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills. They forded the river, which would have been swollen in the springtime from the snow melt in the mountains of Lebanon. Well, they forded it twice and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us." What a very different result here at the end of Joshua 2 compared to the end of Numbers 13, where the spies not only see the positives of what God can do, will do, is promised to do, but their initial mission was to check out Jericho. And they heard that the people were afraid. And their conclusion is what? The Lord has surely given this city into our hands? No, verse 24 says, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us." More accurately, because of God, right? What else do we know about Rahab? Well, some have used her example highlighting the fact that it's possible for Christians to lie under duress and it would be okay. Is that the case? Is that what we read in Scripture? Let's take a look at the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 11. We'll start in verse 29. "By faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned." Verse 30. "By faith the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around for 7 days. 31. "By faith the prostitute Rahab, because she lied about the spies, because she engaged in subterfuge, because she was on friendly terms with the truth. No, because she welcomed the spies, she was not killed with those who were disobedient." But that's just one example, right? Maybe it's okay still. Let's take a look at James. The book of James, chapter 2. And we'll look at verse 25. James wrote, "In the same way was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction." Here she is praised twice for what she did. Not for the lies she told. She was in a process of conversion. I remember hearing a sermon in this room one time comparing conversion to the change a plant goes through. The example was specifically of a corn kernel. As it's planted, it's a seed, but it grows into a plant. And when it's a plant, there is no vestige of that seed anymore. But there's a point in between where there's kernel and plant. Maybe that's what we see here with Rahab. She understands who God is, but maybe is having trouble applying "thou shalt not lie." Did she stay that way? Did she remain a liar? Did she remain in her profession? Let's take a look at Matthew. Matthew chapter 1. This lists the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Verse 5, "Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab." Now, for a time, Joshua had Rahab and his family outside the camp. But at some point, they were welcomed into the community. To do so, they would have had to adopt God, to put away the practices of their Canaanite past, and to take on the practices of God, to become part of the community of Israel. But it says here, "Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab." And we see that Boaz was a father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. What an honor it would be to be included in the lineage of David if it just stopped there, right? But we know it goes on, as this is the lineage of Jesus Christ himself. She did not stay who she was, or she would not have been allowed to be part of his lineage, would she? She changed. She became converted. And in the resurrection, I wonder, what are we going to call her? Rahab the, how are you? Look at what she did, what she accomplished. And she's known as Rahab the faithful. Rahab the collaborator. Well, at some point, she will get a new name. Some things are hard to live down, though, aren't they? As we see here for Rahab. So what's the point? I'm glad you asked. God uses unlikely heroes. Rahab was an unlikely hero, wasn't she? She had three strikes against her. This was a predominantly patriarchal society. And here she is listed not once, not twice, three times in the New Testament. She's listed in Hebrews 11. But she had three strikes against her. Number one, she was Gentile. Number two, she was a woman. Number three, she had a questionable profession. But she was able to change. She yielded to God, accepted him, and yielded to him. And it's good for us to remember at times when we are looking at ourselves, examining ourselves, seeing our shortcomings, and when we are down on ourselves, to remember a person like Rahab, who had her ups and downs, who was able to change quite heroically, wasn't she? So it's important to remember God uses unlikely heroes like Rahab. He can use people like us too, couldn't he? So point number one, God uses unlikely heroes. Point number two, God uses unlikely heroes. Or if you don't want to write it again, you can just put an arrow to number one. You can use the ditto marks or C point one, your choice. Point number two is the same as point number one. It's good to remember at times when others let us down, our brethren, those we meet, neighbors, we don't know what condition the relationship is between God and that person. And they may not seem like a likely hero, but they could be. God does use unlikely heroes. So point one, we need to remember that in ourselves and cut ourselves some slack. Point number two, we need to remember that about others and cut them some slack when warranted. So Rahab became, first, an unlikely friend to the spies. Her friendship at some point turned into an unlikely romance and then an unlikely marriage. And finally, to the inclusion in the lineage of Jesus Christ. She did this all the while she was an unlikely hero.